reading from the Old Testament, 2 Samuel. Saul's son, Jonathan, had a son named Mephibosheth, who was crippled as a child. He was 5 years old when the report came from Jezreel that Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. When the child's nurse heard the news, she picked him up and fled, but as she hurried away, she dropped him, and he became crippled. The king then asked him, "Is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show God's kindness to them." Ziba replied, "Yes, one of Jonathan's sons is still alive. He is crippled in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. "In Lodabar," Ziba told him, "at the home of Machir, son of Amiel." So David sent for him and brought him from Machir's house. His name was Mephibosheth. He was Jonathan's son and Saul's grandson. When he came to David, he bowed low to the ground in deep respect. David said, "Greetings, Mephibosheth." Mephibosheth replied, "I am your servant." "Don't be afraid," David said. "I intend to show kindness to you because of my promise to your father, Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather, Saul, and you will eat here with me at the king's table." Mephibosheth bowed respectfully and exclaimed, "Who is your servant that you should show such kindness to a dead dog like me?" Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and servants are to farm the land for him to produce food for your master's household. But Mephibosheth, your servant's grandson, will eat here at my table." Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Ziba replied, "Yes, my lord the king, I am your servant. I will do all that you have commanded." And from that time on, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table like one of the king's own sons. The word of the Lord.
Well, I want to thank Tom for reading through all those names, right? Thank you, my brother. Mephibosheth. Can we say it? Mephibosheth. You got it. This is a series I began just about a month and a half ago on the life of David. We're looking and calling it the Gospel According to David. And each time here, we're looking at a part of David's life and realizing the importance of who King David was and why he's one of the most written about people in the Bible, quoted 59 times in the New Testament. And what we know, what the Bible certainly uplifts the idea, is that when David was at his best, he reveals a part of the heart of who God is and how that impacts us here, even this day, 3,000 years later. And one of the things that becomes abundantly clear in this, really this passage about Mephibosheth and David and all the surrounding characters here, is whether you're a follower of Jesus Christ or you're someone who's just seeking, someone who's looking, this story is a story about true virtue. It's a story about a high calling, a higher love that I would dare say I think is very foreign to us even in this day. And the more I got into the story, I have to say, this is a story of his life, of Mephibosheth. It's about all of us. There's a part of his life that's in our lives, and you're going to see it here this morning. His story, in many ways, is our story. Now, I think it helps to kind of have some background about this, to understand this, the significance of this and the importance of this figure, Mephibosheth. Let me put a picture up here. This is the ancient Israel, and you see Jerusalem way south, and you see Lodabar way north, about 50 miles from there. What's significant about this? Well, Jerusalem was one of the bigger cities, really, in the world, and Lodabar was in the middle of nowhere. Let me show this next picture. This is a modern-day picture of where they think Lodabar is, just from archaeological discoveries. It was a place you went to get lost. It was a place you disappeared in. People barely could even find it on an ancient map. And this is where Mephibosheth is from. Now, why is he from there? And this is important, and I need to give some background about this. Mephibosheth is the grandson of Saul. So let me just put Saul's name up here. Saul was the king of God's people for 40 years. We talked about this a few weeks ago. He was not someone who was particularly righteous. And we know that God had his hand on David, that he would one day make David a king. But Saul had a very righteous son, I'll put his name up here, named Jonathan. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. That was not my point here, but... And Mephibosheth was one of Jonathan's sons. Now, here's what I find so significant. Jonathan's best friend was David. Very, very close. They made pacts to one another. They made oaths to one another. And what Jonathan and David both discovered is that Saul had made his life mission to eventually kill David. Because Saul knew that God's hand was on David. And Jonathan said, I will do everything I possibly can to protect you from this happening. I think even Jonathan realized that he realized David's greatness, that he was a man of destiny. Even though Jonathan had a claim to be king, he knew David had a higher calling. And so here's what's significant. So let me just show this next slide. Saul and Jonathan are both killed in battle at the same day, the same time. Now here's why this is very significant here. Mephibosheth was basically the last man standing. But we know this in the ancient world, it was very, very common when a new regime came into play, when a new political power came on the scene, almost in every case, the previous political power, everybody was eliminated. Everybody. The entire house was killed. All the children, all the grandchildren, anybody even associated with that political figure. And Mephibosheth is the last person left. And the nurse, his caretaker, quickly realizes this and realizes she flees because she realizes we're all going to be killed. On the way out of trying to flee, she drops him. And it permanently devastates his legs. We don't know what happened. My guess is he probably got severe breaks and never healed correctly. But we just don't know. We know he never walks again properly. And this is very common in that day. In the name of social stability, in the name of political stability, David, what everybody would told him, you've got to make sure, you've got to kill his family. And eventually David becomes king. And everybody believes this is going to happen. Everybody believes David's going to wipe out all of Saul's family. Because Saul had tried to kill him. And the exact opposite happens. The exact opposite. David does the exact opposite. He ends up bringing Mephibosheth from Lodabar down to Jerusalem. He gives all the land that had belonged to his grandfather back to him. And he says, you are going to be one of my sons. You are now going to eat at the king's table. Which I find very, very significant here. And very, very important. And he basically says to him, don't be afraid. Because Mephibosheth was absolutely terrified that David was going to kill him. That he was going to wipe him away. That he was going to be just obliterated. And David does the exact opposite. He adopts him. He sets him up economically. And this is absolutely nuts in the world's eyes. And I think it reveals the heart of God. And the first point here that I think that stands out here, at least to me, is this first point up here. God's grace finds us even when we are not looking for it. God's grace finds us even when we're not even looking for it. And how many of you here can testify to this? The years, especially those who are a little bit older here know this. The younger are discovering it. But God continues to pursue us over and over and over again, even when we do not want him. Even when we try to walk away from him. As C.S. Lewis called, God is the hound of heaven. He sets the hound out and he tracks us down. And we know this. And think about this. Mephibosheth is in the middle of nowhere. And God brings him home. It's the story of the Bible. It's the story of God's people. He brings grace into people's lives who don't seek it, don't deserve it, continually resist it, and never really even fully understand it. And Mephibosheth is in hiding. David finds him, plucks him up out of there, out of obscurity, and brings him to Jerusalem. Let me show this next picture up here. This is a famous painting from Rembrandt. of Jonathan and David. And Jonathan finally reveals to David, I found out my father is trying to kill you. He wants to destroy you. And David is absolutely undone because he loves Saul. He wanted to be a son to Saul. And David basically makes a pact to him. He says, and they made a pact to each other, we will protect each other as long as we possibly can. And David says to Jonathan, if one day I ever become king, okay, I will honor what you ask. And this is what he says here. This is what Jonathan says to David. As long as I live, to David, I want you to show me the kindness the Lord does. And if I die, if something's happened to me, never stop showing that kindness to my family. Now I want to underscore that word kindness here. Because this is huge, huge. And this is where I did a deep dive into this. And I'm so glad I did. Because it's nearly impossible to translate this word the way we see it here on the screen. It's an incredibly deep, ancient word. Because it's difficult to translate. And it was used either for an individual or for God's people. But it can mean both grace and mercy. And yet it also is grace and mercy surrounded with covenantal love. What is covenantal love? It is a steadfastness and a loyalty. That's a love that is there for somebody no matter what happens, no matter what we do, even if by our own hand, by disastrous decisions we find ourselves in the worst circumstances possible, that love is still there with us now and always. It never leaves us. And Jonathan is saying, this is the love, this is the kindness, this is the goodness, this is the mercy and grace, the covenantal love that God has given me. That David, I now pass on to you, that I want you to pass on to my family, that you're always there for them. And this is incredibly, a profound, profound concept and image here. There's a part of Mephibosheth here that I think we also need to see that we all carry. That's in all of us. And this is why I think this is so important about understanding this idea of covenantal love here. Look what this passage says here. Notice what he says here. What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? Again, I kind of did a deep dive on this the last couple of weeks here. This is why I think this is so significant and why this hit me so, it hit me right to the heart. And that is this, that the it's a Hebrew metaphor that is used to either describe someone who is basically trying to, you know, self-deprecating about just basically almost making fun of themselves to kind of reduce themselves or to make fun of themselves in front of other people, or it means how we view ourselves. It's more of a shame term. We feel shame. That is the word that Mephibosheth is using to describe himself to David. He feels shame. Now, why do we know that? Here's how we know it. Mephibosheth's name literally means the shameful one, the undesirable, which has led many, who would ever name their son that, right? Which has led many people to believe that he may have had a different name when he was born. But after he became crippled, after he became physically disabled, when he could no longer walk, that's the name that everybody called him for the rest of his life. Why should anybody even notice someone like me? You ever felt like that? Which leads to the second point here. So many times, God's people, we forget to view our lives through the lens of the gospel. Instead, we view our lives through the lens of what is wrong with us, through the lens of shame. We view this world and our lives through how people often define us, even how we define ourselves. Shame is simply, I am not good enough. And I heard this phrase this past week, and I think it's proper here. Brene Brown defines shame like this: the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore we are unworthy of love and belonging. she nails it. Because I'm telling you, being in ministry for 2 decades now, and now that I know my own heart, that's exactly right there. This goes at the core of who we are. Shame, I'm just thinking of what I've heard over the years, what I've experienced, what I've heard other ministers tell me. Shame is your spouse leaving you for somebody else. Shame is being caught with a DUI. Shame is having to declare bankruptcy and losing everything. Shame is being called out by your boss in front of all your other coworkers. Shame is flunking out of college when all your other friends are succeeding. Shame is realizing when your children finally see how screwed up you are that you've always been trying to hide. All right? Shame is infertility. Shame is not being able to find a date for the prom. Shame is never having your house clean enough. Shame is having your children who you raise up in the faith walk away from it. And you're trying to pick up the pieces. Shame is honestly, people, church, the lens with how we view much of our lives and how we define ourselves. And what I've discovered is it's the voice that never seems to go away, does it? It is always there behind the scenes, telling us all the time, I'm not good enough for my children. I'm not good enough for my spouse. I'm not good enough for my parents. I'm not good enough for my friends. I'm not good enough for God. And the reality is, this is what hit me like a ton of bricks this last week. The reality is, I'll put the picture back up here. Shame wants to keep us in Lodabar. It wants to let us live there for the rest of our lives. You don't deserve to get out of Lodabar. You don't deserve to be in Jerusalem. You stay there forever. We never make it to Jerusalem. And the byproduct of this is it leaves us emotionally distant from those we love, from friends, from family, from those we work alongside of, you know, for people in our own classes, those we share life with. And what shame constantly does, it constantly tells us to look at ourselves and basically says, how we see ourselves, this is who you are. This is who I am. Shame wants us to be defined by the words. I'm thinking of Mephibosheth here. It wants it to be, we want to be defined by our broken lives. We are defined by what is broken inside of us. That's what shame does. But this is the beauty of this passage. This is why this is so great. Because it brings it back to Mephibosheth. The beauty of this story is here. I don't know if I can possibly communicate it the way it's screaming across in this passage here. It's not how we see ourselves. It's how the king sees us. And ultimately, in the end, I mean, David is a symbol and a foreshadow of God. It's how God sees us. And when Mephibosheth comes before the king, he's scared, and David says to him, I don't want you to be scared. I'm giving you all these lands back, and not only that, I want you to sit at my table for the rest of your life. Which brings me to this last point, okay? We have been invited to eat at the king's table. This is good news, church. This is good news. We have been invited to dine with the king. And I have to tell you, the more you look at this, especially in ancient times, to be invited to eat the king was an incredibly high calling and honor. It just didn't happen to eat because it's a familial event. You know, strangers, workers, acquaintances, you had drinks with them. Drinks are for strangers. Meals are for family. Those that are close to us. And David is basically saying to Mephibosheth here, you never need to be worried again. You are home. You can put your bags down. You're home. You can exhale. It almost reminds me, it's shades of the prodigal, okay? When he comes home, I don't care how messed up you are, what you look like, put rings on his fingers, sandals on his feet, put the best robe on him, kill the fattened calf. My son is home. And look at this passage here. Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table. Look at that. Like one of the king's own sons. How beautiful is that? There's one last thing that I'll say that stands out about this. And I did not notice this until this past week. It just all of a sudden came across. I was having dinner on Thursday night with a group of young adults. And we were eating. Maybe because this passage has just been stuck in my mind. It occurred to me, as I was sitting there eating, we were eating at tables, it occurred to me, and I just put this here, thinking of Mephibosheth here, to eat permanently at the king's table was a familial event. You're with family here. But I thought about that. Okay, you're sitting at a table, and I think about the image that's being communicated here. Mephibosheth can't walk. His legs are broken. And yet, when he's at the king's table, nobody can notice that, can they? There's a covering here that covers the blemishes. And when you sit at the king's table, okay, none of the impairments matter anymore. Especially with family. It doesn't matter. As has been said to me before, every story in the Old Testament whispers the name of Christ. This is certainly one of them. When you sit at the table of the Lord, when you sit with family, our lameness is covered by the tablecloth of grace. It always has, and it always will. And there's something about the connection of family that covers our lameness. The table of fellowship covers the blemishes, the brokenness, the things that don't work well. And I got to tell you, I would be rather sitting at the king's table, broken, then spend the rest of my life healthy and out of my own, completely by myself. And so would all of you. And the greatness, by the way, of this invitation here is a reminder, and this is what I think is so beautiful about this is the gospel here. We're not at the king's table because we deserve it. Or we're worthy of it. If anything, it's the opposite. We're unworthy of it. And that's what makes it so great. It doesn't matter what we look like, how broken we are, how messed up we are. All that matters is the king loves us and wants us there. As long as I live, the kindness that God has shown me, I'm not worthy of it. I didn't earn it. I don't deserve it. May I never ever stop showing that kindness that the king has shown me to those whose lives move near our own. And that is true for you. The kindness God has shown you, and I think Jesus expands this. It's not just for family, it's even those outside the family. Love God and love our neighbors as ourselves. Grace finds us even when we're not looking for it. Always view our lives through the lens of the gospel. In the end, always remember, this day, henceforth, and forevermore, we are invited, and we're about to come to the Lord's table again, we are invited to dine with the King. And so it is with you. Let's pray. Our Father and God, we are about to come to your table as God's people. It's because of your death, and it's because of your resurrection. It's because of the cross you've made it possible. Behold the cross, day by day, hour by hour, The dead are raised. Us sinners are saved by the work of your power. And Lord, if this life, like Mephibosheth, if it should bring suffering, if it should bring hardships, we will remember what your death and your resurrection, what Calvary has bought us, both now and forever. It's in your name and for your glory we ask and pray these things. Amen.